Hey guys, Mike with Flight Bridge Ed. I've been an EMS training officer since 2008, and I don't know how many times I've had to deliver the bad news to someone about an expired certification. That means no work. That's where Piace comes in to save the day. Never be caught off guard again with an expired cert. Go to the App Store for your device and search for Piace, P-I-A-C-E-T, the one-stop application to manage and share all of your certifications. You know you don't want to be that guy or gal, and don't rely on your agency to tell you about your certifications. Go to Piace to manage your own certs and have some peace of mind. Download Piace today.
The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and Flight Bridge Ed in their entirety. This is the Flight Bridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey everybody, Eric back with you. Tonight I am joined with Chris Meeks. He actually drove all the way here from Tulsa, Oklahoma area. I'm just finishing a review course in Hot Springs, Arkansas, and my wife and I are flying out from Little Rock, and Chris came and joined me for a little evening podcast session. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good, man. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, well, it's pretty cool that you took the time out of your busy schedule to drive all this way to meet us and to touch on this hot topic right now. This hot topic is high-dose nitro.
High-dose nitrates and heart failure patients.
That's right. Well, before we start, I do want to kind of give you a plug. Chris has recently started a podcast. His podcast, I'll let him introduce this, but listen to the first episode. I thought it was truly amazing, and I really am on board. I'm a supporter. Got some cool things that we'll announce later on, but why don't you introduce the podcast and what your mission is.
Well, thanks for the kind words to start out with. That's really heartwarming to get that feedback. Mind Body Medic is the name of my podcast, and I really got there. The name started as my mission statement, because to master ourselves as paramedics and as nurses or as critical care providers, we really have to master two things, and that's both our mind and our body and the way that they communicate with each other. And so if I can help people educate themselves through cutting-edge science, up-to-date research, and reviewing the basics and remembering just the simple ways to make our day-to-day workflow better, then we can be better providers and then help the professional develop as well, ways to improve yourself as a leader and as a teacher and you know, field training officers or supervising nurses, et cetera. And then mastering the skills that really come along with the book knowledge. You know, you can know all about how to start an IV, but if you don't know the tips and tricks and ways to make yourself good at it, there's really no point in doing it, and all the way up into the more advanced skills. And once we can master our minds and control our bodies under stress, then we can really transform into paramedics.
Yeah, and I think that's great. And, you know, I think the thing that I love about that is the mental side of really anything. Anytime you become a professional in anything you do, and you talk to professional athletes, and, you know, that's something my dad always talked about. My dad was a world-class sprinter and was an alternate on Olympic team track and field in the 60s. And he always told me when I was young that the number one aspect was not his athletic ability. When you got to that point, everybody is so close together, it's more about the mental toughness. And so I think when you get nurses, paramedics to the critical care level, I think you're to that pinnacle, and it comes more about the mindset. How are you going to treat your patients, and how do you take care of yourself health-wise? How do you separate yourself when you're in a agency where maybe you have specific people that are those downers?
All right.
And I always say, don't let the circumstance you're in define you. Mm-hmm. You define your path in life. You set yourself apart from others, and you do you.
Right. You know, the body of what I want to see for the next generation of EMS and really encompasses what I think most of us want to see. You know, we want to see higher scope of practice, and we want to see better pay and better education, and that starts with the motivated generation that are going to A, demand it, and then B, turn around and create it. And, you know, I had a FTO, and when I first started in the field, Boomer Ryder, he guided me through the first 9 weeks of my EMS career, and then has been a true mentor to me going on. He drove home the fact that we're not here for ourselves. We're here for two people, and that's the next paramedic coming under us. We need to get all the experience and knowledge we can to share with them. And most importantly, we're here for the patient. So we need to set our egos aside and just take care of people. And that's really what MindBodyMedic's all about. It's mastering ourselves to take care of people and create a better generation of EMS providers.
Well, I fully agree, and I think that that's well said, and I think the mission that you've started is going to be good.
Well, thank you.
See if we can help you grow that and get your message out, and I'm excited for you.
I'm thankful for all the guidance you've given me, Eric. That's been cool, a heck of a few weeks.
It's awesome, man. Why don't we jump into this podcast? This podcast isn't going to be too long, guys. This is a newer concept. You know, for you nurses out there that are maybe entering into the critical care realm, you may or may not have seen this. You know, I'm not saying this is absolutely the newest thing, but it definitely is a newer thought process. And so why don't we start with a case? I'm going to read this case, and then we'll jump into the physiology and kind of look at what it means. What are we talking about when we talk about high-dose nitro? So we have a 60-year-old male with a history of hypertension, diabetes type 1. He's in end-stage renal failure currently. He is on dialysis. He presents to the ED with shortness of breath. He has had his dialysis regularly. There hasn't been any missed appointments. On arrival, you find him with a blood pressure of 205 over 105. His pulse is 120, respiratory rate of 30. He's got a normal temp, and his SpO2 is below 90, so we'll say less than 90. He does have some pulmonary edema based on chest x-ray. He does have bilateral wheezing and rails noted on auscultation. And they immediately start with some high-flow oxygen. They give three tablets based on sublingual nitro. And at this point, they rapidly start BiPAP. They then continue, and they give four consecutive doses of 1 milligram every 2 minutes nitro IV push.
Wow.
Bam.
Those are some numbers.
1 milligram. So, guys, think about that. If we give a sublingual spray tablet of nitro, that is 400 mics. That's 0.4 milligrams. They're giving 1 milligram, so that's 1,000 mics every single 2 minutes.
That's IV push.
IV too. Push. What do you think about that?
Physiologically, it makes sense, but boy, the numbers, they're off-putting when you first hear the data. I think some of us get afraid to repeat our single sublingual doses earlier than 5 minutes. When you look at the results that we're seeing and the statistics that are coming out of these studies, it's mind-blowing, and really physiologically, it makes sense.
Yeah, and you know, we'll introduce some of the stuff, and it really is acceptable. It's absolutely fine to actually get up to, we were reading at some levels, 3 milligram pushes. That's 3,000 mics.
Every 2 minutes. In one study, the mean dose in the patient population was 6 milligrams in the first 10 minutes of care. So 6,000 micrograms IV push nitroglycerin in the first 10 minutes of care. And they're really saving people's lives. And less than 3% of those patients are having symptomatic hypotension at any point. And even the symptomatic hypotensive patients are able to receive further doses of nitro and are not seeing negative outcomes. And the increase, they're seeing massive decreases in ICU stays and admissions as well.
Well, and I think here's the thing, and I think we've I was talking to my wife about this, and she pointed this out, and you know, she has done a little research on this as well. And the studies have really looked at, when we think about people in pulmonary edema, and we think about what are the treatments, standard CHF treatments, we're going to give our nitro, and then it was 40 to 80 Lasix. And what they've realized is that they found that half of the heart failure patients, they're not actually overloaded. They don't actually have fluid overload. They have fluid in the wrong spot, right? And so it's the treatment should be focused on the fluid redistribution, optimization of the hemodynamics. And you're doing that by using the nitro. You're not eliminating the fluid. You're essentially looping the fluid, and you're putting the fluid into the correct spot.
Absolutely.
It's not diuresing them and getting that fluid gone, because that's not going to fix a problem. You're fixing the underlying issue. So why don't we introduce some physiology there? I'll kind of let you guide this. As you can see, guys, that this blood pressure was 205 over 105. So, Chris, why don't you explain the difference between a dilated, basically they have an EF problem, right? They cannot get the volume out of the left ventricle. And what does our body do in that circumstance?
Well, our body is full of autonomic responses. When it recognizes a problem, it compensates with another. And the way we're compensating in these situations is our ejection fraction goes down, so our SVR comes up. That's our systemic vascular resistance. And if you get into the depths of hemodynamics, just like you would in one of your classes, you'll see that trend through various forms of cardiogenic shock. So when the left ventricle stops doing what we need it to, or the heart stops doing what we need it to, the SVR clamps down. Our distal vasculature shunts, and it becomes very difficult for our heart to push the blood past it. And so it just makes sense that the nitroglycerin is dilating that arterial vasculature, that vasovasculature out, and making the tank bigger again, so there's less work for the ventricles to push against.
Sure. And I think that's the thing, is this is a hypertensive heart failure. You know, and we have to remember. So remember, you know, we've talked about this in other podcasts. We've talked about this in the review course. If you've joined us there, we have two main forms of heart failure, of left-sided dysfunction. We have a systolic and a diastolic dysfunction. Mm-hmm. So we have a dilated cardiomyopathy where we have overstretch. Remember, essentially, that heart is based on the Frank Starling curve.
Yes.
And it's all about the amount of stretch you get is the amount of total blood flow you get, you know, the better stretch. Our heart can do one of two things. It can basically become floppy. It wears out. Mm-hmm. It just can't maintain that strain and that stretch, or it becomes restricted. And when it becomes restricted, that's where you're going to have a big problem, where you'll have an overload situation. You're going to have more, you know, pressure put back on that mitral valve. You'll have that mitral valve regurge, pulmonary edema. They're going to have a poor ability. That heart is going to be almost calcified. Like, you know, the not only the left ventricle is affected, but the right ventricle is affected as well. And Absolutely. It's almost like the entire apex is just calcified. You know, our muscle can either become floppy or it can grow, and that myocardium is like any other muscle. And so, you know, a patient that has that hypertensive response, that SVR is going to skyrocket. That's the way we compensate. And I always talk about this in our review classes, is there's two reasons why our SVR goes up. It's really only two reasons. It's a volume problem, meaning we're volume depleted and our body is compensating, or it's an overload problem on the left side. Those are the only two reasons that happens.
Well, it's an easy analogy to connect to our ventilators as well. You know, when our tidal volume goes down, our respiratory rate goes up, and vice versa. Tidal volume goes up, our respiratory need goes down. Well, just like we have a need for minute ventilation, we have a need for cardiac output. So when our cardiac output goes down, our body's going to respond in one of two ways. The question is, between our healthy patients and our unhealthy patients, is who can tolerate it longer. And when your patient's no longer tolerating it, they get this huge catecholamine surge trying to compensate, and it just pushes them further over that cliff, and we end up with this massive pulmonary edema problem. And that's where fixing the SVR and moving that fluid and taking control of our patient really comes into play.
Yeah, and so when we think about high-dose nitro, you know, if you consider we've always given that 0.4 milligram sublingual dose and spray, and I always, you know, think about different times in my career, you know, you get on an ambulance, if I was working a 12-hour and somebody left a half spray on that nitro, it's like you go and give a spray to some patient and you only get a half spray, what do? You're kind of like, you know, do I give another spray? Now I've just given a spray and a half, or... You know, what do you do?
The tablet didn't dissolve all the way because their mouth was dry.
Yeah. I think primarily in my career, I've been, I don't know, fortunate. I'm not saying fortunate, but I've always had the sprays, and I don't know if that's still a standard. Probably a little out of the loop on the ground side there, but.
It just depends on what area of the country you're working in.
Probably. Yeah. But a 0.4 milligram dose, that's equivalent to 80 mics a minute. If you think about it. So it's 400 mics.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to give it one 400 mic spray or tablet every 5 minutes. So you divide that 5 into 400, and that's 80 mics a minute.
Yeah.
So that's the equivalent. So the funny thing is like when I've read charts or, you know, you have newer, and it's usually the paramedics that do this, they haven't used a nitro drip. Our dose range is 10 to 200. That 10 to 200 is, you know, they'll start at 10, and go to 15, go to 20. So just realize, guys, if you do have a nitro drip, 400 mics, that sublingual sprayer or pill, that is 80 mics a minute. Don't be afraid to increase that dose. And that's why you always see nurses. They'll go from 10, they'll shoot up to 100 mics.
What would we do without nurses?
I know. It's great.
It's unbelievable.
But it all it shows that we are cohesive, that we learn from the nurses, they learn from us. We both have areas that are our expertise and our comfort zone, and medicine is so wide ranging. Just because we may not use a medication in our setting, that doesn't mean that medication isn't used in another setting. And we have to understand that there's lots of different applications in medicine. You know, we can't have a blanket statement on every single thing.
Absolutely. Well, so pushing right along into that, so we move from that 10, 15, 20, 25 mic dose, and then the nurse steps in and says, hey, you dumbo, let's move it up. You get up into the 100, you start seeing a little bit of improvement, and you start titrating off that 100 to even higher and higher. And then suddenly our patient starts getting better. What I think this concept does is takes out the downtime of getting to that therapeutic dose and hits it or overshoots it and then brings it back to it. And we're minimizing the amount of time our patient A suffers and B has a worsened disturbance systemically from the poor ventilation and hypoxia. And moving to those higher doses faster is improving outcomes across the board, decreasing ICU admissions and ICU stays overall, massively reducing intubation rates in CHF patients.
Yeah, and you know, so the dosing, you know, if we go start it right at 80 to 100 mics and you shoot it up and you go to 300 or 400 mics, you know, that's what we're talking about here. Again, going up to the point of 1 to 3 milligrams over, you know, 2 minutes, every 2 minutes until you have a relief of symptoms. And, you know, these patients respond pretty quickly. I mean, those are massive doses.
Well, we should clarify this protocol is not taking the place of CPAP and BiPAP in these patients. This needs to be done in conjunction with. The first thing you should be addressing is the CPAP and BiPAP. Get the patient oxygenating again. I like to use the analogy of a full bathtub. We need to drain the water out of the bathtub, and the bathtub's our lung in this situation. Well, we can A, unplug the drain, or put more pressure above the water and push it through the drain we already have. Well, why not do both? So we're going to give our nitroglycerin at higher doses and clear the drain up, make the drain flow better. And we're going to put pressure above the water and empty the bathtub faster and retake control of it.
Yeah, so to kind of recap, you know, the standard treatment and kind of what we're saying is that non-invasive is going to be absolutely a must. You got to start non-invasive. Always go, you know, consider CPAP over BiPAP. I mean, I think I'm always probably going to go BiPAP because I think bi-level is much more comfortable. You know, if you don't have bi-level, you only have CPAP, then that's fine. But they need that in conjunction with high-dose nitro. We have to understand that nitro lessens both the right ventricular and left ventricular pressures. It decreases that overall systemic blood pressure, which is the SVR, and it's going to improve cardiac output. And it does that because it ultimately lessens that SVR. You have a left ventricle that cannot contract appropriately. You have a heart failure situation. So imagine trying to squeeze a bulb and you have a hose above that you have kinked off. That's essentially what that left ventricle is trying to do. And so if it can't do that, that blood is going to back up into the mitral valve, and that's where you get the pulmonary edema. So if we can reduce that systemic vascular resistance, that automatically will improve cardiac output. It will, you know, and so it's an opposite thought process. We have a high blood pressure. We have a poor cardiac output. But if you drop the blood pressure, you're going to improve cardiac output. So, you know, you have to really think about how that works. High doses of nitro, like when we're just small doses, we're not cutting the mustard. High doses of nitro work both on the arterial and venous side, and they decrease both preload and afterload, but we have to be at that high dose.
You know, statistically, that high dose really starts at 100 mics. You're not affecting that systemic large vasculature until you're hitting at least 100 mics of IV nitro. So starting at 10 and 15, just doesn't make sense. So if I'm hanging IV nitro at this point, I'm starting at 100, absolutely, and titrating up, or I'm gonna start at these much higher doses if my protocol is gonna let me do it at 1, 2, and 3 milligram IV push over 2 minutes, and really get the patient out of the woodworks and back to a place where we can take care of them without them needing to be intubated.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we do have to say is every protocol is different. Mm-hmm. You know, if your protocol, I know protocols out there that'll say, hey, start at 10 mics per minute. That's fine. And then you can escalate your dosing, and you may have, you know, this is where my previous employer was very good about, they were guidelines. And the guidelines were meant to be a guideline. Doesn't mean that they are set in stone. That's where you have to critically think. If 10 mics is 10 mics for a chest pain patient, that is completely different than a hypertensive heart failure patient that is drowning in their own fluid. And so that's where you may have to make the decision to go to that higher escalating dose. But we're not advocating to work outside your protocol. Obviously, I don't know of any EMS protocols out there or you know, HEMS protocols that are doing high dose 1 to 3 milligram IV pushes of nitro. It is being done in the hospitals. I've met many nurses in our review classes that are seeing this done. I actually had one nurse that actually said he watched a doctor do 5 milligram push. 5 milligram push, and he said that the patient responded perfectly. He was blown away. So we just want to introduce this to you. We will publish the literature that we're referring to in the show notes. Remember, the show notes are going to be under the podcast on the FlatBridgeHead website under this specific podcast, and then you can download that. That will be a PDF. Is there anything else you want to hit on?
I think the most important thing here is to be aggressive in these acute crashing pulmonary edema patients. Whether or not you know the physiology, if they're hypertensive and they're drowning in their own fluids, you're working against the clock. We can go deep into the physiology of why we don't want to wait on these patients, but get your nitro on and get aggressive as fast as you can. And don't be afraid of that. We've always been so afraid in the pre-hospital setting of these high doses of nitro or nitroglycerin in general. It's just so important that we put the patient first and just get aggressive and put our ego aside and our fear aside and get aggressive. I think the other side of this, initially when this information came out a few years ago, they were giving 8 to 10 milligrams of morphine along those lines, and you'll still find a lot of data that has that in there. And I just want to kind of make a point that it's no longer supported. It is a generally bad idea to give high doses of opiates to respiratory distress patients.
Sure.
You're not going to see the improved, you're not going to see the vasodilation that we thought we would see out of it, kind of like we used to in the old Mona protocols. What you're going to see is more respiratory suppression, which is going to further any respiratory acidosis that's going on with that patient, push them closer to failure.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And I think you have a lot of these old school thought processes that you still see, and we have to remember that medicine is always evolving. We're always learning. And, you know, think about one of the things that we really push in our view classes that we talk about, and you get these, I watch people's eyes, and I think it's an epiphany, is when somebody's in respiratory distress, what do we always do? Well, they're sitting up, they're tripoding, they're sitting forward, they're struggling, and we lay them down, right? We need to make sure that they're sitting up, make sure that they, you know, any patient really, you know, any patient we intubate specifically, well, obviously we're not going to try to intubate these patients. We're going to use non-invasive. I think we need to be using more non-invasive on more patients, be comfortable with non-invasive. So if you're not comfortable, practice it and practice it. Put it on yourself and practice it. I've even put it on Chris before. I've got a video of it.
You set it pretty high, too.
I did. I just wanted to make sure that he could handle it. And so he did. He handled some pretty high pressure. I just wanted to demonstrate, you know, what happens when you don't know additive versus absolute. Mm-hmm. And I was teaching. And so I'm sorry.
I forgive you. It was a great education. I'll never make the mistake again. I promise you that.
No. Anyway, well, I think this is a great podcast. I think that we have you know, hit on some pretty good physiology and introduce this, and you know, maybe we'll do something to follow up when more literature is published. But again, check out Chris's podcast. I think you'll really enjoy it. I don't plug very many podcasts, and I think this one is going to be a great podcast for years to come.
I really appreciate that. I'm excited for the future.
Awesome, man. Well, on behalf of everybody at FlatBridgeHead, I want to just say thank you. If you're looking for a elaborate class, we've got classes scheduled all the way out to May of 2019. And remember our online university. I just want to thank everybody. We've It has been an absolute success, and really appreciate that. So on behalf of everybody at FlightBridgeEd, we will talk to you soon.
This has been a production of the FlightBridgeEd podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.